Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. By the way, you want to join my book club? If you are a reader, and I hope you are, I hope you'll read along with us. This month we're reading Send for Me by Lauren Fox, novel set in Germany on the eve of World War II and present-day Wisconsin as well. It looks at themes like sacrifice, belonging, and family ties. I'm reading it right now. It's a dandy book. And you can read along with us and then tune in on March 24th when we speak with author Lauren Fox of Milwaukee. That's the novel Send for Me on the Larry Mueller Show Book Club here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Turning our attention now to diabetes, people are developing diabetes at younger ages and at higher rates. And according to the CDC, more than 28 million Americans have been diagnosed with diabetes. But more than 8 million people don't know they have it. And today we're talking about strengthening diabetic care in underserved communities with our guest, Eva Vivian, professor in the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. She's also a fellow of the Association of Diabetes Care and Education Specialists. And I hope you'll join in our conversation. Maybe you're a person of color with diabetes. When were you diagnosed? Give a call regardless at 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Professor Eva Vivian, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you have a passion to educate the public about diabetic care and prevention, especially among underserved communities. What's inspired you?
Well, I've cared for people with diabetes for over 25 years. And what I learned when caring for them is that there's so many factors that influence their care that go beyond the medications that we provide them. So this piqued my interest to learn more about factors that do influence the health of our patients, particularly those with diabetes.
And I understand you wear a glucose monitor, but you don't have diabetes. What do these monitors tell people?
Well, about 15 years ago, I realized that I was telling people to do things, but I didn't realize the impact that it had on their life. So what I decided to do was to wear an insulin pump for a week and try to follow the instructions that I gave others. So it would give me an idea of some of the challenges that they face when they are wearing this pump and they have to adhere to some of the recommendations I provide for them. And I tell you, it's really challenging having diabetes. Everything you do will affect your blood glucose or blood sugar levels. For example, if you forget to take your insulin or your medication, your blood glucose levels can get too high. You'll have side effects of the medication sometimes. And even eating, having to count the carbohydrates in a meal can be quite a challenge. And if you live in an underserved community and you have a limited income, this is also challenging because eating healthy is very expensive. Fruits and vegetables are very expensive. So it gave me a real view of what my patients face. And it also altered how I advised them to care for themselves based on the resources that they had available to them.
And interesting. And as I understand it, you also had a best friend in elementary school had diabetes.
Yes, my friend Angela suffered from type 1 diabetes. And at the time, I clearly didn't know what I know now, but I distinctly recall Angela stating that she would go without her insulin for 2 days because she realized by doing that she would lose 10 pounds in a couple of days and be able to fit into one of her favorite dresses. And we didn't think much of it at the time, but by the time we started college, Angela was found to be legally blind. Yes, and when she was married at the age of 25, she became pregnant and had a lot of difficulties during that pregnancy. Her baby only survived for a few months. And at the age of 30, Angela needed a kidney transplant.
Oh, boy.
She died because she was diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 39. And of course, she couldn't receive the treatment for breast cancer, which was chemotherapy, because she was required to take drugs that would suppress her immune system so she wouldn't reject her kidney. So I often thought, if I only knew then what I do now, I could have helped my friend.
Oh, man. And you mentioned type 1, and there are two types.
Yes, there is. There's type 1 diabetes that there is a genetic predisposition, but patients with type 1 diabetes cannot make insulin, and insulin is required for their survival. Then there is type 2 diabetes that until recently, usually impacted people 40 years of age or older. And with type 2 diabetes, there's a resistance to the action of insulin in our body. And as a result, we don't produce as much insulin as we did in our youth. However, what's becoming concerning is that many of our young people under 21 years of age are now developing type 2 diabetes that used to be a disease that we used to refer to that impacted our grandparents.
Oh, boy. And we know why that's occurring?
Well, we are finding that there's a strong relationship between type 2 diabetes and being overweight or obese.
Okay.
And being overweight tends to make your body resistant to the action of insulin. So as a result, your pancreas is still producing insulin, but your body isn't responding to the insulin.
Does genetics play a role in any of this?
Genetics can play a role in type 2 diabetes. We have found genes associated with this, but also we have found that people who are overweight or obese who lose a significant amount of weight can actually reduce and in some cases eliminate their requirement for medications for diabetes.
And you focused on helping minority populations is one thing I really want to talk with you about. We're kind of coming up to the top of the hour here, but what populations are you focusing on or talking about?
Well, over the last 15 years, I've worked in predominantly Latino and African American communities. And more recently, I received funding from the American Diabetes Association to look at the effect of peer support in a diabetes prevention program targeting African American grandmothers who are the primary caregivers for their children. Are their grandchildren.
And so that's ongoing research right now.
Yes, it's ongoing research.
Well, that's something we will dive into a bit more. And as we move along today with our guest, Professor Eva Vivian, professor in the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. She's also a fellow of the American, or the Association of Diabetes, let me start again on that. She's a fellow of the Association of Diabetes Care and Education Specialists. And we'll talk with her more about that as well. And certainly you can join in with your questions. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we will be back with Professor Eva Vivian and talk more with her about her work in diabetes. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about diabetic care and how to strengthen health equity among minority populations with our guest, Eva Vivian, with us. She's a professor in the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, also a certified diabetes care and education specialist. So have you had problems with treating your diabetes? Have insulin costs held you back from getting proper treatment? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Professor Vivian, we had a caller from Madison who couldn't stay with us, but wanted to know the connection between obesity and diabetes, which I think we kind of may have answered here. But, I wondered, does the obesity come first or does the diabetes come first? And then if you could also, this caller wanted you to talk about insulin costs.
Okay. Well, that is a very good question. Does obesity come first or does the elevated blood glucose or blood sugars come first? First of all, I'd like to clarify, while obesity is a risk factor for developing type 2 diabetes, all individuals with type 2 diabetes are not obese. There are several factors that can cause type 2 diabetes, one of them being a genetic predisposition. If you have a family member, a parent, a sibling, or even a grandparent who has had type 2 diabetes, the likelihood of you developing type 2 diabetes increases. Often, as people begin to gain weight, what happens is that their muscles in their body become resistant to the action of insulin. So the cells in their pancreas that produce insulin will still release insulin, but insulin is unable to do its job. And what insulin essentially does is it opens up panels within the cells that use sugar for energy, and it allows glucose to go into those cells so they can be used for energy. Now, what happens in many overweight people is that they develop what's called insulin resistance, where their muscles of their body are resistant to the action of insulin. So insulin is there sitting on those cells, attempting to let glucose into those cells, but the cells are not responding. So as a result, the glucose begins to accumulate in the bloodstream. And as a result, we develop what is termed hyperglycemia or high blood sugar. And what people find is that when they become more physically active or they begin to lose weight, then their body becomes more sensitive to the action of insulin again.
And in terms of the cost, the caller also wanted to know about the cost of insulin. It's kind of expensive.
It is, but some insulins are more expensive than others. And I would really encourage the callers that are receiving insulin to talk to their providers about what they can afford. All too often, when patients visit their doctor, the doctors just write a prescription for insulin, and they're not aware of what patients can afford. But it's important to speak to the doctor about what you can afford, because there are several options. There are some pharmaceutical companies that offer a patient assistance program. And this will require completing paperwork and showing proof of income. But in some cases, a patient may be able to receive their insulin at a reduced cost, and in some instances for free. And then we have in Madison, Wisconsin, a 340B pharmacy located within Access Community Health Center, Wingra Clinics facility. And this particular pharmacy is able to purchase medications at a cheaper price in exchange for providing these medications at a lower cost to the patients. So this is also an option. So, for example, if you were provided a prescription for an insulin that was extremely expensive, you might be able to get that insulin at a lower cost, or maybe for no cost at all based on your income.
Pat in Three Lakes, Wisconsin, has a question for you. Let's go there. Pat, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I don't know whether this question pertains to your guest or not, but I was just curious, as a non-fasting lipid panel, would a 117 glucose reading be high?
For, and your age is?
80-year-old.
You're 80 years
81.
Old. 81, okay. Yeah.
Now, you had a non-fasting lipid panel, and your glucose was 117?
Yes.
If that is not fasting, then that is a very good glucose level.
Oh, all right.
Yes. Have you been diagnosed with diabetes?
No, not at all.
Okay. So for someone who does not have diabetes, a fasting number, a fasting glucose of less than 100 is normal. And a non-fasting number of less than 130, 140 is normal. So 117 is a very good non-fasting number.
Oh, there you go. Put a smile on your face, Pat. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You mentioned Madison, and you spent your career getting to know patients in this area. What do you hear from people as far as their knowledge of diabetes, what they know about it?
Well, the knowledge varies. Some people have a great deal of knowledge because they have been diagnosed with diabetes and they've had to care for themselves for many years. However, I've met people that have had the disease for over 20 years and still they have some misinformation that they've received from family or friends. And I have to work with them to provide them with accurate information.
And I believe you mentioned this, or if not, I had it in my head. African-American adults are 60% more likely than non-Hispanic white adults to be diagnosed with diabetes by a physician. That's according to the Office of Minority Health Resources Center. Why is that the case?
That's a very good question. And there's a number of reasons that could attribute to those numbers being as high as they are. One could be that some African Americans don't have a very good relationship with their provider, therefore they're not keeping their appointments. I think that providers have to be very diligent and test for diabetes annually. Now, one of the concerns that I've had, and the recent pandemic expose the lack of trust that many African Americans have in the medical system. And often I've heard people refer to historical injustices within the healthcare system, such as the Tuskegee study, where Black men were denied penicillin and were tested so that the researchers could see the impact of syphilis on their bodies. But when I spoke to people who were vaccine hesitant during the summer, they often referred to how they were treated within the healthcare system. And because of that, they didn't trust the system. So if a patient does not trust their provider, they are less likely to take the advice that that provider provides for them. And this is something that I think that healthcare providers, all healthcare providers of all racial ethnic groups, have to think about and address going forward so we can provide better care for our patients.
And how do you view hypertension among African American populations? Is this the leading to more diabetic diagnoses?
Well, I often tell my patients that hypertension and diabetes are first cousins, and they often coexist. So years ago, when I was just starting in my career, I started a hypertension clinic at a VA hospital in Philadelphia. And it was very interesting. When I ordered labs, I found that many of the men were not diagnosed with diabetes, but they had elevated blood glucose levels. So as a result, my hypertension clinic became a cardiac risk reduction clinic because I was managing people with not just hypertension, but diabetes. Hypertension is, African Americans have the highest prevalence of hypertension in the world. And I think now we can attribute one of the factors that can cause hypertension as racism, the ongoing stress that African Americans endure on a regular basis can actually contribute to ongoing stress that causes an elevation in their blood pressure.
That is, it's sad and sometimes hard to believe. And you know, what could, how we fix this?
That's a very good question. And it's not something that only one person can fix. We as a society have to fix this. And we have to face the conditions and the challenges that some people in our country face. I feel that structural racism has contributed to racial residential segregation. And as a result, we have groups, particularly African Americans, as well as other groups of color, that are somewhat marginalized and isolated from society as a whole. And these marginalized groups have limited resources offered in their community. If you go to an underserved community in Madison, for example, you'll notice that there are not as many grocery stores that carry fresh produce. And often the schools in underserved communities are under-resourced, so they can't provide children with the education that they need to really be successful. And this is a problem across our country. And often when we're segregated, the more privileged group doesn't recognize or realize how the less privileged group is suffering. So it becomes an ongoing battle for us, but it's something that we all need to address and try to help those who are less fortunate in our society.
We received a listener email. The person says they're not an insulin diabetic, only on metformin. That's an anti-diabetic medication.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Can you explain why the morning of blood testing and after fasting, why their meter would read 149, but the test result for the day is 179?
So they're testing their blood glucose level using a glucometer, and they're getting readings throughout the day of 149. And where does the 179 number come from?
Well, the morning of blood testing and after fasting, their meter would read 149, but the test result then for the whole day is 179.
Yes, and that's understandable. If you haven't eaten for 8 hours, more than likely your blood glucose number is going to be lower. We expect a lower number first thing in the morning when you haven't had anything to eat for 8 hours. But throughout the day when you're eating, you're consuming food, particularly carbohydrates, things like bread, fruits, candy, and your blood glucose levels then rise. So for a person with diabetes, we ideally want their fasting blood glucose level to be less than 130 milligrams per deciliter in the morning. Then throughout the day, we want to keep that number to less than 180. And those are the American Diabetes Association's guidelines. So a postprandial number, which is a number after a meal, is usually higher than a fasting number.
So, and I'm going to go, the listener email mentioned metformin, anti-diabetic medication. How does that work, or what does it do for the body?
Metformin is regarded the workhorse of the anti-diabetic medications, and the American Diabetes Association recommends it as first-line treatment for type 2 diabetes. And what metformin does is it actually helps the muscles in your body to store glucose more effectively and to listen to the insulin that's circulating in your bloodstream. And it also helps the liver to store extra glucose. So what happens is if I eat a sandwich right now, that sandwich is going to be broken down in my stomach to the simplest form of sugar, glucose. And then that glucose flows into my bloodstream. Now, if I've just walked about 3 miles, my muscles are going to take up that glucose because they need it for energy. But they may not need the entire sandwich. So my liver will store the remaining glucose and save it for a day when maybe I forget to eat a meal. And so the liver will release that glucose in emergencies. But the liver only stores so much glucose. So any extra glucose beyond what the liver can store is stored in the fat cells. And that's what can promote becoming overweight, because the fat cells do store extra sugar.
And the metformin then eliminates that, or what does it do?
Well, what it does is it helps the body to be more sensitive
to
the insulin, so that the muscles as well as the liver can store that extra glucose.
You mentioned earlier that you've got funding from the American Diabetes Association for research on prevention of diabetes. And how are you using the funds? Be interesting to know.
Absolutely. I'm still caring for people with diabetes, but as you mentioned at the beginning of your program, there are three times as many people with what we term pre-diabetes. It means that their blood glucose levels are elevated, but they're not high enough to be diagnosed with diabetes. What's concerning is that a large percentage of these people will go on to develop diabetes every year. So about 20 years ago, a diabetes prevention program was tested against the drug metformin that we just spoke about. And a certain percentage of people were just told to just live like they normally live. And then another third of the individuals were given metformin. Then the third group was told to see a dietitian every week and to meet with a physical activity specialist. And these people were termed the intensive physical activity group. Interesting, after a couple of years, they found that there were fewer people in the intensive therapy group, the individuals that were physically active and following an intensive nutrition program, that went on to diabetes, to develop diabetes. And this group had fewer people developing diabetes, even when compared to the metformin group. And this is a drug.
Yeah.
So we learned that physical activity and healthy nutrition work. And together, they are just as effective as a drug to treat diabetes. So I proposed actually offering the DPP program to certain women in underserved communities, but to also provide peer support. And the reason why is because after the DPP program was found to be effective, they attempted to offer the program in certain healthcare settings and community centers across the country. But what they found was that they didn't have the same outcomes among African Americans that they found in the original study. And I believe that that was probably due to a high attrition rate. Many women and men dropped out of the program. And I think if you can offer this program in a community setting and train people within the community to be peer educators who support their peers within the community to lead a healthy lifestyle, this might increase the chances of these individuals remaining in the program and then benefiting from the program. So my plan is to train African-American grandmothers to serve as peer educators. Then we will recruit our grandmothers within the community to participate in the DPP program and be supported by their peers.
That's interesting and great work. And I want to thank you so much, Professor Vivian, for being with us today and talking about it. I hope we can do this again. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Professor Eva Vivian of the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, our guest today. She's doing some wonderful work, and I appreciate her being with us today. Well, it's Leopold Week, and tomorrow we'll talk with an environmental and science journalist and a representative from the Aldo Leopold Foundation about Leopold's legacy. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.